the man they call a war criminal of his new title.
It's a designation routinely awarded to former prime ministers here, but anti-war campaigners say they're repulsed at seeing Blair receiving it. And they have their reasons.
For millions of people in this country, it's an absolute insult, as it is to the people of Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, and various other places where we've now seen the war on terror over the last 20 years. And I don't see any justification for it whatsoever. I think that Blair never conceded that he was wrong about any of these things. The Chilcot inquiry, which was very, very critical of him, he immediately held a very long press conference afterwards and said he would do exactly the same again.
In mid-February 2003, just before the Iraq invasion, tens of millions of demonstrators in hundreds of cities across the world, including in London, marched against the impending U.S.-led war in the Middle East. To Tony Blair, the biggest protest march in British history was fatuous.
The fact is that had we been listened to and had Britain not taken part in the war almost certainly would not have taken place, that America would have been much less likely to go to war alone, and we would have seen a much different world today, a day where far more people would be alive as a result of that war not happening, would be far fewer refugees.
The U.S. claimed the regime of former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein possessed weapons of mass destruction and actively pressed for invading Iraq in late 2001. The weapons were never found. 2 decades on, 1 million Iraqis dead, 3 million dispossessed, and a region reeling from terrorism and instability. Hundreds of British troops were also killed in the same conflict. Anti-war campaigners say Tony Blair belongs in the dock at The Hague, and not in the pantheon of great leaders. Saeed Purizab, London.
Cleared of criminal damage charges at Bristol Crown Court, Rhiann Graham, Myla Ponsford, Jake Scoos and Sage Willoughby dubbed the Colston Four celebrated their acquittal in a trial that's divided British public opinion. For those who had been on trial, relief and a sense of vindication.
We are ecstatic and stunned. I tried to write something ready for this moment, and I'm just so overwhelmed.
We didn't change history, we rectified history.
We illuminated history. Daylight, we illuminated history.
And this is the victory for Bristol. This is the victory for racial equality.
And this is where it began, at a Black Lives Matter demonstration in Bristol in June 2020.
I think the court accepted that this was almost a political show trial, that Boris Johnson and the Home Secretary, Priti Patel, had determined that they wanted to make an example of the Colston Four, and the courts rejected that.
The jury's verdict has garnered mixed reviews, with some MPs writing to the Attorney General, asking him to look once more at the wrong result. Elsewhere, there have been calls for the Home Secretary to explain why this case was so heavily pursued in the first place, and what happens now when that move has seemingly backfired.
The focus is now on high-profile monuments like the statue of Sir Winston Churchill, Britain's lauded World War II leader, but a figure that's being seen increasingly through the lens of his controversial views on race and empire.
New legislation being pushed through under the Police and Crime Bill will make defacing monuments punishable by up to 10 years behind bars.
Women watchers to your station will be surprised to know you can get longer for pulling down a statue under the new provisions than you do for rape, which is absolutely bizarre. But it shows the extent to which this government is intent on pursuing culture wars and criminalising the Black Lives Matter movement.
There is the hope that many local and national stakeholders will use the outcome of the Colston Four trial as a teachable moment, a chance to reflect on Britain's chequered past. But then again, maybe it will just be business as usual. Amina Taylor, London.
Hisham Abu Hawash has been refusing to eat for 141 days. But he's finally breaking his fast because the Israeli regime has agreed to release him next month. Abu Hawash has been receiving a great deal of support from the Palestinian people, who have rallied, protesting his unjust detention and demanding his freedom. And now these people finally have a reason to celebrate. In Al-Khalil, Abu Hawash's home, his supporters have turned out to rejoice this victory against Israeli jailers. His family had a especially tough time in recent days after doctors warned that Abu Hawash's health was deteriorating, that he was slipping in and out of coma and facing the danger of sudden death. Now they can finally breathe a sigh of relief.
I thank all the Palestinians who stood with us. Thanks to everyone who helped my brother. I thank God they released him.
During the past 3 days, we lived through a psychological war that was carried out by the Israeli intelligence due to what was happening with my brother Hisham. There were strong maneuvers, but we overpassed those as a family. Today, Hisham achieved victory for all the Palestinians.
Now, Abu Hawash's lawyer says he would be hospitalized for medical follow-up before his designated release on February 26. Palestinian officials have weighed in, praising his resistance.
Hisham Abu Hawash prevails after 141 days of hunger strike. We hail Hisham for his forceful will, his family, Palestinian people, and people around the world who raise their voices in solidarity, thanks to countries that press Israel to release him next month on February 26.
Resistance movements have also poured praise on Abu Hawash, saying his victory should remind Palestinians how they can win every battle against Israel. The 40-year-old father of five children was arrested in October 2020 and started his hunger strike early 5 months ago to protest his detention without charge or trial that is allowed under Israel's administrative detention system. His lengthy hunger strike once again shed light on this illegal practice. Out of 7,000 Palestinians in Israeli jails, more than 500 are locked up without facing any charges or having a trial. For many of them, the last choice against this inhumane measure is to stop eating for lengthy periods of time. Still, the majority find themselves locked up in deplorable and non-standard conditions of the Israeli prisons, where they are sometimes even subjected to systematic torture and harassment.
In late 2020, Americans went to the ballots to pick the country's next president. 4 days after votes closed, Joe Biden was declared the winner. But the incumbent leader, Donald Trump, alleged vote fraud, and in doing so, shattered Washington's self-proclaimed image of the cradle of democracy. Trump adamantly refused to concede defeat after losing the 2020 presidential vote. On January 6, 2021, he called on his supporters to march on the Capitol and, quote, stop the steal. His fans attempted to do that. The world was shocked as news networks around the world showed thousands of Trump supporters forcing their way into the Capitol building, the symbol of U.S. democracy. Lawmakers engaged in the process of certifying the presidential election had to stop their task and flee for their lives. Some reports even suggest that a Republican senator was so frightened that he asked the Capitol security repeatedly to shoot the protesters. 5 people died in the chaos, one of them in the Congress building. To date, American authorities have arrested nearly 600 people and are looking for hundreds of more suspects. A big portion of the defendants stand accused of assaulting police officers. The FBI asked U.S. citizens to report each other out and tell the police if they knew anyone who had taken part in the riots. The incident inevitably had adverse consequences for the United States' image, both domestically and internationally. An opinion poll conducted last year by Harvard University showed that more than half of the country's young generation thought that American democracy is in trouble or failing. Moreover, an Axios survey indicated that now only 51% of the U.S. public thinks the next presidential election will be fair and free. Also, the Democracy Perception Index for 2021 showed that 44% of participants perceived the U.S. influence and meddling in the affairs of their countries as the biggest threat to democracy in their nations. At the same time, politicians and political analysts expressed shock and disgust at the chaotic scenes at the Congress grounds. Richard N. Haas, the president of the Council on Foreign Relations, said the attack signaled a post-American era. The assault on the Capitol changed the face of Washington, D.C. as well. The Congress building was fenced off on multiple occasions after the riots. Furthermore, Joe Biden's inauguration was carried out under heavy military presence. with an unprecedented 25,000 troops ensuring security. That was bigger than the number of U.S. forces present in Iraq and Afghanistan on the same day. The police reaction to the Capitol riots also raised questions about the U.S. law enforcement's differential treatment of white protesters. Whereas black people could be killed and injured for much smaller crimes, police were in fact criticized for their late and subdued response to the deadly protests by Trump's supporters.
Representatives of resistance groups gathered in Beirut to pay tribute to Iran's top commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, and senior Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. The two anti-terror icons were assassinated in an American drone strike outside Baghdad airport on January 3, 2020. Participants in the event all agreed that Soleimani united the region in the face of a common threat posed by the U.S. and Israel.
Their martyrdom did not weaken the resistance. On the contrary, it led to more accomplishments and success for the resistance. They are alive. This type of life is what gives a strength to the resistance. Martyr Qasem transcended his country to become the martyr of the entire nation, and this is an exceptional characteristic.
Hezbollah Deputy Secretary General Sheikh Naim Qasem stressed that people in the region will stand united and confront the threat posed by the United States. Meanwhile, the Secretary General of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad Movement, Ziad Nakhala, described Soleimani as the martyr of Palestine and Al-Quds.
The U.S. assassinated Soleimani because he was a barrier to American Israeli plots in the region. He transformed the resistance fighters into a strategic threat to Israel and the U.S. I take this opportunity to say that we're proud of the positions of the Islamic Republic of Iran, which is unwavering in its support for the Palestinian resistance, and I witness that Qasem Soleimani was at the forefront of the fight in defense of Palestine and the people of Palestine.
The Iranian ambassador to Beirut also said that there is a joint Iranian-Iraqi judicial lawsuit being followed up by both countries to try the killers of the Iranian and Iraqi martyrs who were assassinated by the United States.
Resistance groups in the region consider General Qasem Soleimani as a man and a leader who united them. People in Lebanon, even those who knew him only after his martyrdom, see him as a man who transcended borders and sacrificed his life for the sake of the people and regional peace and stability. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
This international conference is the gathering of Islamic scholars converged in the port city of Karachi against Islamophobia. They believe Islamophobia is a Western project to reshape Islam with tools like Daesh and others.
Participants of the conference stress on the need of unity among Muslims and call on the Islamic countries to take serious notice of the forces hell-bent to sow seed of discords among Muslim Ummah.
Documentary films during the past years over the gruesome acts of Daesh in the name of Islam were played to remind people how terrorist groups were weaponized by Israel and the U.S. to distort the face of Islam in the West.
Actually, Islamophobia is a project of Western country who do not like the Western people come to Islam like Islam. And they mention many things that hurt the heart of the Islamic people, while Islam is the religious of love between the people.
This conference is very important for me, all Pakistanis and all Muslims, because there has been so many criminal activities on behalf of non-Muslims or Western countries against Islam and Muslims.
Member of the international conference warned the Islamic countries to act quickly against the possible future threats given the previous experience with the West.
Islamophobia had been created to balance the teachings of Ahle Bayt alayhimus salam. It was created to balance and misguide people from the way of Quran and Sunnah. Things took place in the name of Daesh and so-called. And they did things which were absolutely against the teachings of Islam. They never understood.
The delegation in the conference also stressed the significance of the eradication of Daesh from Iraq and Syria to save Islam and also save humanity from the plague of terrorist groups like Daesh, which is seen as a Western plot against Islam and the Islamic community. Mohammed Turi, Karachi.
Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah lashed out at the United States as the mother of corruption and terrorism in the region and stressed that the expulsion of U.S. forces from the region will be the final revenge for the U.S. assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and Iraqi Popular Mobilization Unit's commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis in Baghdad in 2020.
We've declared earlier that the best revenge is the full withdrawal of U.S. troops from the region. And over the past 2 years, as the leader Imam Sayyid Ali Khamenei said, the U.S. has been forced to leave Afghanistan with humiliation. This has led the U.S. allies to rethink their alliance with Washington.
In an address to a ceremony in Beirut remembering the martyrs Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis and their companions, Sayyid Nasrallah also accused the U.S. of being behind all Israeli and Saudi crimes in the region for decades.
The lesson which I would like to highlight today is that everyone acting for the sake of God emerges victorious in all battles and wins the hearts and minds of all people across the Arab and Muslim worlds. They show us that the U.S. serves as the real enemy and source of corruption, occupation, and terrorism in our region.
Allies believe that the project of the resistance continues to face the criminality of the U.S. in Lebanon and the region.
Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani belongs to the school of thought of a struggle against the occupiers of our land and those who destroyed our homes and killed our people and led one war after the other with their support for the Zionists. He sacrificed his life and stood against terrorism in Iraq, Yemen, Syria, and Lebanon and Palestine. He taught us that Lebanon is strong enough and can remove itself from the U.S. hegemony.
The leader of the resistance stressed that the assassination of martyr Soleimani, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, has triggered a new phase at the regional level.
The assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and PMU commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis is seen as an incident larger than the region itself, and for many analysts has brought to light a long-term confrontation for Lebanon's Hezbollah facing U.S. influence in Lebanon and the region. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among thy troops are the victors, and place me in thy party, for thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among thy friends, for thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging. And to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless thou forgives it, and leave no grief unless thou takes it away, and leave no enemy, and leave no enemy unless thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names, in the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is his anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is his good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from thee, O patron of beneficence.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Now, the United States' assessment of the Islamic Republic of Iran has been problematic since the victory of Iran's revolution in 1979. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has reiterated the U.S.'s miscalculations regarding Iran. He said Washington thought with its terror assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani that all of his efforts would have been in vain. But the reality, he says, is that the opposite is true. The committed people of Iran are following and continuing his way more now than ever before. So at the end of the day, what does it all mean? Stay with us as we take a look at this on the Spotlight.
Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has delivered a speech on the anniversary of an uprising in the Iranian city of Qom on January 9, 1978, against the toppled U.S.-backed Pahlavi regime. The leader reminded the United States of its miscalculations and wrong policies toward the Iranian nation. He pointed to the visit of then-U.S. President Jimmy Carter to Iran several days before the Qom uprising. In that visit, Carter had described the circumstances of Iran under the Pahlavi regime as an island of stability. But later, Ayatollah Khamenei said Carter had to try to quell more uprisings across Iran to prevent the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution, a goal he failed to achieve. The leader said the U.S. has made more miscalculations regarding Iran. He added, an outstanding example is the 2020 assassination of anti-terror icon Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Since the Islamic Revolution, successive U.S. presidents have left no stone unturned to achieve their anti-Iran ambitions through different means, including military threats and imposition of sanctions. In line with that policy, former U.S. President Donald Trump in 2018 withdrew his country from the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, known as the JCPOA. That's a deal Iran clinched in 2015. Trump imposed tough sanctions on Iran as part of his so-called maximum pressure campaign, a policy incumbent American officials, including Secretary of State Antony Blinken, have explicitly admitted that has failed. Nonetheless, the current U.S. administration seems to be pursuing the wrong policies of its predecessors toward Iran. One example proving that is the U.S. refusal to remove the anti-Iran sanctions in order to pave the way for reviving the JCPOA that got into trouble because of Washington's withdrawal. Now, it's up to the White House to decide to take a lesson from those wrong policies and reverse course, or continue the same anti-Iran agenda.
I'd like to welcome my guests to this spotlight out of Berkeley, Paul LaRudy, activist and political commentator. And Elijah McNair, veteran journalist and political analyst out of Brussels.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome you both to the program. Well, let's start this off in Berkeley. And Paul, your overall assessment, what is it all about, Paul? There's so much animosity that comes from Washington towards Tehran that even started, even leading up to the revolution, even before the revolution miscalculation. What is it all about in your perspective?
Marcia, I think there is what you can call a more global view and also a very short-term view. The situation actually at the time of General Soleimani's assassination was that, let's say, there was an opportunity that was spotted by the military, saying an opportunity for assassination, that is. And it means that they were, of course, watching his movements and preparing for the possibility of assassination. And the short-term view is that they presented that to Trump and to President Trump, and President Trump saw it as an opportunity for him. That is to say, he was not being presented very well in the press, and he decided that an assassination like this, regardless of its actual strategic value, would boost him in the polls and make him appear to be a hero, or at least become a hero in the press, if you will, on a very short-term basis. And he took it. He wanted the glory, if you will, as the United States would see it. But there is
another. Paul, what exactly does that mean? I mean, you say that basically he took the bait. He decided that's what he wanted. He wanted the glory. But the system in the U.S. is not really individual-based as such. Wouldn't you say, I mean, there's something extremely problematic, to say the least, about an entity that sits down and thinks that, oh, okay, so assassinating this general representing another country on a diplomatic mission is actually an opportunity. I mean, let's look at that side of things and what we're saying about that entity.
Well, that's the other side of what I was going to mention. That is to say that there's a larger picture, but on balance, it's very possible that, you know, there were equal sides on the issue within Washington's and the Pentagon's calculating as to whether they should do it or not. But the side that had a, let's say, a more calculating and long-term view realized that General Soleimani was a problem for the United States because he was eliminating the terror threat in the Middle East, and because he had negotiated with Putin and was important in persuading Putin to join the fight in Syria in a limited way at that time, and because he unified forces in the region and the views, and because he had the respect of all of that. And so in that sense, they wanted him out of the way for these reasons.
Okay. Stay with me, Paul. Yeah. Let me get Elijah in on this conversation. Elijah, in the early days of Iran's revolution, Washington continued to say that Imam Khomeini was going to die any day, and after he would die, then the revolution basically would be over. And we've seen so many different types of miscalculations along the way. And, of course, with the assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, I want to talk about that aspect, that it really expected the resistance in the region to be stunted now, to be impeded or to go in another direction by assassinating him. Of course, he was a very, very important figure. But as the leader of the revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei, said today, with his assassination or his martyrdom, actually, support for the resistance has grown.
Thank you for having me. I think what really happened is we can't exclude the ignorance of President Trump and the team he had around him to inform him that removing or assassinating General Qasem Soleimani would deter the access of the resistance, would weaken Iran, because everything is related to one man and one man only. And that's pure ignorance, really, because the axis of the resistance is made of several population who have decided to fight against the U.S. hegemony and dominance, and they want the U.S. forces outside of their country. Now, that is not depending on one man. It is the ideology, it is the country, it is the principle, and it is the fight behind the cause and not behind one single man. And when President Donald Trump assassinated Abu Bakr Baghdadi, the Daesh emir, he thought that Qasem Soleimani could be more or less the same thing at the same level, and he can get rid of him like he did with Abu Bakr Baghdadi without soliciting any reaction. And what he did in a moment when the color revolution was starting to pick up a little bit in Iran, where people in the street were destroying banks and official institutions, creating havoc in the country, burning gasoline station, etc. And the Americans, with their limited thinking, they thought we can create more, we can give more boost to this movement of the population that the Americans are behind, and we can cripple more Iran and submit it so it accepts the U.S. dominance, and it, at the end of the day, it aligns itself for what we want. This is why Donald Trump imposed maximum pressure on Iran to cripple the population and submit Iran. So by assassinating unlawfully an envoy of Iran and an advisor to the Iraqi government in Iraq, in Baghdad, he thought that he can get away with it and it would be a simple act. He didn't realize that Qasem Soleimani boosted a new blood in the revolution in Iran, because we saw millions of people in Iran, but also we saw millions of people in Iraq. And that also helped the axis of the resistance to remember who is the enemy, and that the U.S. should be removed from the area, because the only thing it is doing is just killing, particularly a general who was the main force behind defeating ISIS in the Middle East.
What about that, Paul? I mean, Elijah said that there's ignorance there, especially dealing with Trump and those around him. But we're not just talking about the 4 years that Trump was president. We're talking about more than four decades of miscalculation in dealing with the Islamic Republic of Iran. What is that about? I mean, what exactly does that mean? We have many strategists, all kinds of think tanks in Washington and beyond. So your assessment of it.
Thank you. That's right on point, Marzia. And Elijah is absolutely right. There's one side of it that's based on ignorance. And it's being used by people in the state and adjacent to the state, who are the deep state, you could say, that are using this ignorance for their own purposes. And those purposes are partly, in fact, in large measure, the purposes, the Zionist purposes of the State of Israel and the Zionist movement. But it's also part of and allied to a deep state that wants to impose by military force its domination of other countries, and other countries which are currently dominated by the United States and which have puppet regimes of the United States installed there are sort of left alone. They're not, you don't see the U.S. Destroying those countries except by exploitation. But the other ones, which insist on being independent, and Iran is certainly a nation that wishes to remain independent, as does Syria and Iraq and Venezuela and North Korea and Nicaragua and Cuba and on and on. There are these that are considered problem states, problem countries that the United States has to deal with. And what the policy towards those countries has been, and still is, that these countries have to be taught a lesson. And at the very least, they have to be destroyed. If they won't submit, then they have to be destroyed as an example to other countries as to what happens to them. So this, and this is very much part of the Zionist thinking, which benefits the State of Israel by using the U.S. military to fight the perceived enemies of Israel. So those interests are very much allied with each other, and that's not a case of ignorance. This is a case of very deliberate use of military force, economic force through sanctions, so-called sanctions, and destruction. And this is a theory of how the United States can continue to remain in power throughout the world.
Well, Elijah, continuing on that theme, I mean, do you think that it is because of a lack of understanding about Iran that there still is so much animosity and the actions that are taken against Tehran, or is it actually because they have a very, very good understanding of Iran and the possibilities of Iran and its support, not only support for the resistance, but actually being the leader of the resistance?
I can't say that the U.S. Has a good understanding of what's happening in the Middle East, because we saw what the Americans did in Afghanistan after 20 years. We saw what they are doing in Iraq. They were asked to leave in 2011, and now they are asked and will be forced to leave. We saw what they've done in Syria. They're occupying a part of Syria, and they don't know what to do, to remain or to leave, and they really can't figure out what's the best solution. We see what they are doing in Lebanon, and yes, I agree with your guest about the element of Israel and Benjamin Netanyahu at the time when Donald Trump wanted the support of the Israelis in his re-election. And actually, Donald Trump blamed Israel for not going to war against Iran. Well, the Israelis are much more clever than the Americans at that time, because they know what the cost of confrontation, a military confrontation with Iran, and what would be the consequences and the cost. Well, I think the Americans, everything they have done in the last decade was a total failure. From the beginning, when they say we're going to Afghanistan to destroy Al-Qaeda, they haven't been able to do that, to destroy Taliban. They negotiated with the Taliban, who are back in power. They say in Iraq they want the weapon of mass destruction. What they have managed to contribute in the rise of a resistance that is part of the axis of the resistance that was directed its strengths and its attack against the U.S. forces. Now in Syria, it's picking up. In Lebanon, they were kicked out in the 80s, and now they're trying to come back with the sanctions. So I don't see any clever policy of the U.S. apart from an elephant in a China shop, just breaking left, right, and center, and then leaving without even saying, I'm sorry, and say, well, what I have destroyed is only the consequences and of what I have done, and you can live with it, because there is no accountability. This is why the Americans can do what they are doing, because they fear and consider they have no consideration to international law, and they have no consideration to any law whatsoever, because there is no accountability.
Well, Paul, your take on what Elijah said as far as the United States not having any accountability, I want to look at overall how this miscalculation, whether we're talking about with Iran or Afghanistan or Lebanon or Syria or so many examples that Elijah just brought, what has it done to the United States itself?
Well, I don't think you'll find many people in Washington that will admit to a miscalculation, and that includes the think tanks and the part of Washington that studies very carefully what's going on and so forth. But there's a lot of disagreement between the forces in Washington, and there's also a lot of arrogance. So you and I may call it a failed policy, but the.
If we just take Afghanistan, I mean, 20 years and how much money spent and leaving the way they did, I find even very few Americans would say that was successful policy that they adhered to in Afghanistan with
Correct.
The results if we look at it.
Yes, that's what they would say, but that's not what they say in Washington. What they say in Washington is that this is time well used, because the influence of what's going on in Afghanistan, it gave them a presence in the Middle East, and it pushed and it gave a warning to adjacent countries, don't mess with us, and all this kind of thing. This is the way they think. This is what I'm telling you. I'm not saying it's a good way of thinking. I'm saying that this is the so-called expertise that they have there, and they would say, yes, we didn't achieve everything that we wanted to achieve in Iraq, But on balance, it's still very useful. And as long as there's war going on and there's a war economy in the United States and the United States can destroy anybody on the face of the earth, we're in a good situation. That's the kind of thinking you're dealing with.
Okay. Well, Elijah, we just have about 1 minute. Your overall assessment, I mean, the United States, especially after the assassination of General Soleimani, many would say that the reputation, whatever was left of it, has deteriorated rapidly. Your analysis of the United States right now in the region compared to prior to the assassination, how it has deteriorated and where do you see it going from here?
I think the assassination of Brigadier General Qasem Soleimani brought something new to the Middle East. Soleimani's death is more to be feared by the U.S. than when he was alive. And I think this has raised the awareness to so many people about what the Americans are doing in the area, in the Middle East, and what they are capable of, and how they think they can do whatever they want. And people are working to push the Americans outside the Middle East now as soon as is possible. And we see what's happening today in Iraq, where they are attacked every single day just for the Iraqi to make a point and say to the Americans, just leave us alone. We can sort out our problems without your presence.
And on that note, I appreciate both of you being with me here. Paul LaRudy, activist and political commentator out of Berkeley. Elijah McNear, veteran journalist and political analyst out of Brussels. Thank you both. And thank you for being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us right here.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Closer, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. Beautiful sound of azan, the call to prayers. In front of my house, there is a small mosque which has two tall minarets and blue tile work. On top of each of the minarets, green light turns on around the sunset time. The combination of the sound of azan and the green light on top of the minarets make a spiritual atmosphere which makes me calm. It's interesting to note that minaret or mil is an Iranian structure that has entered the Islamic architecture. Today we are going to take a trip to Khorasan Razavi province, to Firuzabad village. We are going to visit Firuzabad Mil. Minaret or Mil literally means the place of light and brightness. In ancient Iran, minaret or Mil was built for guiding travelers. These mills were built on the sides of roads and routes. People used to set fire on top of the mills so that caravans or travelers could spot the light in dark of the night or during foggy days so that they would not be lost. These structures were built separately and were not attached to any building nearby. The oldest mill in Iran is known as Mil-e Ejdaha, which dates back to the Parthian era and is located in Mamasani region of Fars province. In contrast to other mills, which are cylindrical and brick-made, this mill is rectangular and made of stone. There are over 30 mills in Iran today, which most of them date back to the 4th to 6th century AH. Firuzabad Mill or Firuzabad Tower dates back to Seljuqid era. I am now at Firuzabad village. This village is located in a dry, desert-like area. From the point I'm standing, I can see the Firuzabad Mill. I have to take a walk for about 5 minutes in order to see it from a closer view. I am now standing beside the Firuzabad Mill. This mill consists of three parts: the base, the body, and the top. Inside the body, there is a staircase and a light well. This mill is cylindrical and is 18 meters high. However, it used to be 24 meters in the past, and now just 18 meters of it has remained. Firuzabad Mill has two layers and is made of bricks. The architecture of this building is known as Razi style. Oh my God! The brick decorations of this structure are great! There are two inscriptions at the top and bottom of the mill. These inscriptions have been written in Kufi script, so I can't read it. Kufi calligraphy is used in the decorations of buildings and tile works a lot because it's so beautiful. There used to be a spiral staircase inside this mill, which has been damaged by the passage of time. If it was here now, I would go up the stairs and look around from the top of the mill. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio.